welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, bringing you programs from radio's golden years. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. True history coming up in this hour. Later on, a story of Valley Forge on American Portraits from 1951. But right now, a fascinating moment from broadcast and real-life history, where we hear a murder inquest of Johnny Stompanato, a gangster at the time who was in the employ of the infamous Mickey Cohen. He was in a relationship with movie actress Lana Turner and reportedly treated her very poorly, to the point where Turner's 14-year-old daughter Cheryl Crane was fed up and murdered him. The eyes of the nation were on CBS television as they broadcast the murder inquest with Lana Turner on the stand, and according to some sources, saying that she gave the best performance of her life and also looked the part with not a hair out of place. What we'll hear next is a broadcast package prepared featuring excerpts from that inquest in April of 1958.
Special broadcast over the American Broadcasting Network.
Hollywood slaying last week of Johnny Stompanato by Lana Turner's 14-year-old daughter, Cheryl Crane. The American Broadcasting Network took its microphones into the crowded courtroom as the Los Angeles County Coroner's Office conducted an official inquest. There were all the ingredients of a movie. Blonde star, the law officer, an ex-convict. But it was Miss Turner who got most attention as she told everything in the bedroom of her Beverly Hills home. The inquest, however, got off to an abrupt and surprising start when the first witness, Stompanato's close friend, ex-convict Mickey Cohen, took the stand.
What's your name? Mickey Cohen. And your address? 11719 San Vicente Boulevard.
What city?
Los Angeles.
Have you viewed the remains of the person in this matter?
I reviewed some remains, yes.
And was that someone you had known in life?
I refuse to identify the body.
Did you make a statement that deceased person was John Stompanato, Jr.?
I refuse to identify him as John Stompanato, Jr. for the reason that I may be accused of this murder.
Next, Beverly Hills Police Chief C.H. Anderson, the top law enforcement officer in the swank movie colony suburb of Los Angeles, was called to the stand and set the scene of the slaying.
Chief Anderson? C.H. Anderson? Well, you've been previously sworn. Please state your name.
Clinton H. Anderson.
And your occupation?
Chief of Police, City of Beverly Hills.
We must have absolute quiet in this inquest room. Did you receive a call in regard to this matter?
I received a call at my home, yes.
Approximately what time did you arrive at the scene?
Approximately 11 p.m. on April the 4th, Friday night.
Would you please tell the jury the results of your investigation at the scene that evening?
The first person I talked to after a brief greeting from the officer was Mrs. Turner. And she was quite hysterical and weeping. And she says, I introduced myself, the chief of police. And she said, can I take the blame for this horrible thing? I says, no, not unless you have committed the act. And we will find out all of the facts. So you might as well start off with the premises that we are to learn all of the facts. And then she said that her daughter had rushed in her protection as Stompanato had threatened her with bodily harm and threatened to kill her.
Then came the call for Miss Turner to take the stand, the witness for whom the estimated 100 reporters and photographers and exactly 37 spectators who filled the courtroom had been waiting. Her silver hair combed into a modified ducktail in the back, her fingernails silvered to match her hair and wearing a fitted gray suit, the actress walked slowly, almost carefully, to the big leather-backed witness chair. She told of a bitter argument that developed at her home the night of the slaying, a row between herself and Stompanato, which she said was touched off by her mentioning a desire to go out for dinner with friends, leaving Stompanato on his own.
He continued saying these things, and finally I turned to him and I said, I told you. I did not want to argue in front of the baby. I've always called her that. And he said, well, he didn't know why, then why not? And I said, well, we're not going to. So I turned directly to my daughter, and I said, I am going downstairs, and I'm coming right back up, and I'm going into my room. I don't know why I said that. She said, yes, Mother. I said, you watch TV? She said, yes. So I went downstairs with Mr. Stompanato following me, and the quarrel is now becoming more violent. And I answered back that I was just finding out too many lies. And that this one more that I found out was just not the worst lie. But it was one that no matter what made me say to him that I can't go on like this. You know that I have begged, I pleaded for you to leave me alone. Even with all of your threats, which I admit I have greater fear of him. We went back upstairs into my room. Still, I beg your pardon. Oh, Mr. Stompanato and I went back upstairs to my room. Both of us talking at once, he more violently. All I kept saying was, there's no use discussing it any further. But I can't go on like this, and I want you to leave me alone. He grabbed me by the arm, and Mr. Stompanato grabbed me by the arms and started shaking me, cursing me very, very badly. And saying that, as he had told me before, no matter what I did, how I tried to get away, he would never let me. If he said, jump, I would jump. He said, hop, I would hop, and I would have to do any and everything he told me. Or he would cut my face. Or cripple me. When beyond that, he would kill me.
Then Lana's emotional account of the actual slave.
I broke away from his holding my hold of me, and I turned around to face the door. My daughter was standing there. And I said, please, children, please don't listen to any of this. Please go back to your own room. She looked at me. Are you sure, Mother? Because I know that I repeated it, and I begged her. I said, please, child, don't listen to this. I beg you to go back to your room. And she left, and I closed the door. I turned to Mr. Stompanato after I had closed the door. And I said, that's just great. But my child had to hear all of that. They're horrible. But I can't go through anything more. And he kept swearing and threatening me. And he had had a jacket and a shirt hanging in the closet. I forget exactly when it was there, or if he had brought another change from his apartment. Anyway, it was hanging there, and he walked away from me and went to the closet. And it was on a hanger. And he walked back to me and was holding the jacket on the hanger in a way that he was going to strike me with it. And I said, don't ever touch me again. I'm absolutely finished. This is the end. And I want you to get out. And after I said that, I was walking towards the bedroom door, and he was right behind me, and I opened it. And my daughter came in. I swear it was so fast. I truthfully thought she had hit him in the stomach. But as best I can remember, they came together. And they parted. I still never saw a blade. Mr. Stampinato grabbed himself here.
For the rest of the afternoon?
Yes, sir. Started to move forward, and he made almost a half a turn and then dropped on his back. And when he dropped, his arms went out so that I still did not see that there was blood or a wound. Until I ran over to it, and I saw the sweater was cut, and I lifted the sweater up, and I saw this wound. I remember only barely hearing my daughter sobbing. And I ran into my bathroom, which is very close. And I grabbed the towel. I didn't know what to do.
Giving vent more and more to her feelings as she relived the near hysterical situation that she found herself confronting the night of April 4th, Miss Turner described what she did immediately after Stampinato was stabbed.
And I went to the telephone, and I called my mother, because I've been out of the country for so long, and I truthfully could not remember my doctor's number. And I said, Mother, quick, call Dr. McDonald. She said, what's the matter? I said, I can't explain. Just tell him it's an emergency and get here fast. Please. She said, yes, she would. And I hung up and I screamed to my daughter. I called to her loudly because I had gone back beside Mr. Stampinato. And I called her, Cheryl, and she came right in, and I said, help me. I don't know what to do, but maybe some cold cloth. So she went into my bathroom, and she came back with two wet washcloths. I was putting one here, and she was folding the other, handed it to me. I put it on his forehead. And she kept saying, Mama, I didn't mean to do it. I didn't mean to do it. she was so frightened, and I was so frightened. And I kept trying to assure her, it'll be all right. I'm sure it'll be all right. The doctor will be here in just a minute. Granted, it's called, and we're not far away. And with that, she burst out crying again and ran out of the room. I did not know that my daughter had telephoned her father. But he was the next one I saw. I don't know who let him in because only my daughter and Mr. Stompanato and I were there, as I believe I said my maid did not live in. And I remember I was still trying to talk to him, call Mr. Stompanato. Trying to slap his cheeks, and he's still making these horrible noises. And Mr. Craig came in, and I jumped up, and he looked over my shoulder. Mr. Craig, and he said, "Oh my God, this is terrible." And I said, "Yes, I know. It's horrible, and I don't know what to do except what I've done. And the doctor should be here any minute." We told him it was an emergency. Then, I cannot remember this, Mr. Craig, I believe, took my daughter out of the room. I had again gone back to the side of Mr. Stompanato. Then my mother came in. I heard her calling from downstairs. And as she came in, I got up and ran to her and I said, "Mother, please don't look. It's John."
The former sweater girl glamour queen, admitting that she and the others who arrived at her home were at a loss to know what to do when the doctor arrived, then told of the continuing concern even after the doctor showed up.
Immediately opened his bag. And while he was preparing what later I found out to be an adrenaline shot, he said, "Lana, Dr. McDonald said, Lana, you have to call the ambulance." I remember running over and getting the phone and coming right back beside Dr. McDonald and Mr. Stompanato. And he told me how to dial O and to ask for emergency. And it seemed to take forever. They were asking all kinds of questions. Whose name that house was in, whose telephone, all of these things that I tried so hard to answer. And finally, I handed the phone to Dr. McDonald, who stated his name and to rush a resuscitator and told him where. He handed me back the phone. I hung up and he said he was called Dr. Weber. He told me the number to dial. I didn't know what to say, so again I handed the phone to Dr. McDonald, who had already put the shot into the heart and was there's a word for it.
Attempting artificial respiration.
Yes, sir. I'm sorry. And he kept trying to work on him, and then when I had Dr. Weber on the phone, I gave the phone to Dr. McDonald, who While he was talking, then I tried to work on Mr. Stampinato. My mother had come back into the room. She was even trying to breathe into his mouth. All hoping that
climaxing her testimony, Miss Turner related a showdown talk she had with daughter Cheryl after the girl had overheard her and Stampinato arguing 5 days before the slaying. A mother and daughter conversation in strictest privacy.
Mother, I overheard some of those things today. I told her I'm sorry that she heard them, that she could buy them. Why does John say Mr. Stampinato say these things to you? And I heard him threaten you. And she said, Mother, why don't you just tell him that you're finished, just to go? And I said, Cheryl, I have tried. Believe it or not, I have tried very hard and for some time now. And she said, you're afraid of him. And I said, yes, I'm deathly afraid of him because he has hurt me. But I never wanted you, Cheryl, to be any part of this. Then my daughter asked me what had happened in London, she said. What really happened in London, Mother? And I told her that it was absolutely unbearable trying to work. And I was very ill. And Mr. Stampinato would not leave me alone while he was there. And the threat of disfigurement, of being crippled. And he came, and after he had choked me, and threw me down, he went into the bathroom and he cut a wrist. And he came and he grabbed my head. And all the time he's screaming at me such vile things. That he may only start with a little one now, so to give me a taste of. But it could certainly do worse. I begged, I pleaded. I said, I'd do anything, anything, just please don't hurt me. If he claimed to love me, how could he hurt me?
3.5 hours after the inquest started, 30 minutes after the jury of 10 men and 3 women began its deliberations, the verdict came.
The verdict of the coroner's jury in the matter of the inquisition upon the body of John Stampinato, Jr., a male, divorced, a native of Illinois, age about 32 years, and that he came to his death on the 4th day of April, 1958, at 730 North Bedford Drive, Beverly Hills, Los Angeles County, California. This death was caused by stab wound of abdomen with penetrating liver, portal vein, an aorta with massive hemorrhage, inflicted by a knife in the hands of one Cheryl Crane at 730 North Bedford Drive, Beverly Hills, California. And from the testimony introduced at this time, we find the death of the deceased was justifiable homicide committed by the said Cheryl Crane in the belief that her brother's life was in danger.
Thus, another chapter was completed today in the investigation of the slaying of Johnny Stampinato. The verdict of the coroner's jury is only an opinion, of course, not legally binding, and the future of 14-year-old Cheryl Crane still is up to the discretion of Los Angeles juvenile authorities. Their decision will come at a juvenile court hearing later this month. The program was edited by Jim Vinson. These recorded highlights of today's inquest have been a presentation of the American Broadcasting Network News and Special Events Department in Los Angeles. This is Len Beardsley.
The Johnny Stampinato murder inquest on Tuned to Yesterday, that report prepared in April of 1958. Lana Turner's daughter, Cheryl Crane, who committed the murder, was not charged for it, as the courts deemed it to be a justifiable homicide. Though Johnny Stampinato's family sued the Lana Turner estate for $7 million, a case which was settled out of court. This is an hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Now on to the days of Valley Forge and the American Revolution on American Portraits with a story called Reveille from August 21st, 1951 on NBC.
The National Broadcasting Company, in the interests of the American system of radio, presents the seventh in a series of eight dramas by George H. Faulkner entitled American Portraits. Tonight's star, Stefan Schnabel. The makers of the American Revolution were not, all of them, American by birth. To represent the huge and decisive contribution of sympathizers from abroad, we have chosen tonight to draw for you a picture of one of the earliest adventurers in arms who came to the aid of our young republic. His name? Well, perhaps you'd like to guess his name as we go along. The title of our play? Reveille. Time is September in the year 1777. Place, the European home of Dr. Benjamin Franklin at Passy, near Paris. A conversation between Dr. Franklin and a mysterious friend draws toward a close. The language is French, but if we may be permitted to translate.
Time, sir, is of the essence. Arrangements have been made for you to sail from Marseille. On Saturday, you will board the French frigate L'Heureux of 24 guns.
L'Heureux, the happy one. A fortunate name, Dr. Franklin.
Yes, and a good omen, I hope. By the way, you are aware that the aid being given the American colonies by the French court in this matter is highly secret. Entirely secret.
Of course. I do not talk. Since 14, I am a soldier.
Ah. The frigate will be disguised as a merchantman under the name of Le Flamand. You will take ship as one Mr. Frank, bearing dispatches for the governor of Martinique. But you will debark, with the help of God, at Portsmouth in New Hampshire.
Evening, lads.
Well, Sarge, what's new at headquarters?
What's new? Is there ever anything new at Valley Forge?
No. You was going to keep your ears open, Sarge. Didn't you hear anything?
Two things I heard. Two. Listening as I was to the big brass gorgets and their grand powwow.
What'd you hear, Sarge?
One, General Washington has wrote a letter to the gentlemen of Congress. A swilling of their port back in York in front of a fire. Gents, he says, we must have instant aid, or else we must either starve or disband. And the General, God bless him, has heard back.
What did he say, General?
The gentlemen of Congress are sending us
food,
juice,
riches,
guns,
ammunition,
food.
No, lads. They're sending a committee.
A
committee to investigate and report back and so on and so on, etc., etc.
We ought to skin them to make shoe leather.
Point two. The boy made a speech.
Lafayette?
The boy himself. Gentlemen, he says, what this army needs is to be an army. Right now, he says we're not an army at all. We're a mere rabble. Oh, hold on now. He was right complimentary. No ordinary rabble, he says, could have held out like us. But we need somebody to tell us what to do, and how to do it, and why to do it.
Did he have any notions about what we're going to eat while we're doing
Well, no. The point wasn't mentioned. His lordship, the quartermaster general, Mr. Mifflin, he wasn't there. He's in York by the fire, chomping on a side of beef.
That does it. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going home, back to Poughkeepsie, where all the pigs have four legs and turn into pork overnight.
I'm with you. Unbolt the door, Corporal.
That's it.
Corporal, close the door for the love of God. Thank you.
Men, this is Colonel Alexander Hamilton, General Washington's aide on tour of inspection. Colonel, this is what's left of my regiment. 4th New York, as you know.
What was your strength when we went into winter quarters here, Captain Walker?
90 men.
And now?
This morning, sir, there were 30 of us left.
Oh. What are those men doing in their bunks, Captain, this hour in the evening?
We're short of clothing, sir. Some of us have no breeches. We have to share about. The naked ones lie in the bunks.
Huh? Well, let's have a look at this boy. Sleeps pretty soundly. Lift the blanket, Captain.
Yes, sir. Oh, yes. It's Wilson from Newburgh. He was in a bad way this morning. The lungs, you know, and the frost. But he's not asleep, sir. He's dead.
And thus, General Washington, gentlemen of the staff, I conclude my report of conditions here and now. And may I say
that... Thank you, Colonel Hamilton. Gentlemen, you realize the seriousness of our situation. We have 10,000, more or less. Heaven knows how many more, how many less. Some 10,000 troops left.
The sick we can count easily, gentlemen. More than a fifth of our body.
The point I wish to make, General Conway, is that in the European sense, these troops do not constitute an army at all. Despair, lack of discipline, desertions, disorganization. These are the roots of our difficulties.
May I suggest, sir, that the root of our difficulty lies in this senseless, stupid, and utterly destructive attitude of the Congress. Good heavens, sir, even if we win, are we to be ruled by a coterie of timid, greedy dolts and asses?
If we win, Colonel, and we shall win, we will be ruled by the representatives of the people. That is what we are fighting for. The people's representatives will never be inspired judges, nor saints, nor philosophers. Oh, surely this is no time or place for political theorizing. Ours is a practical problem. It has been stated most clearly by Lafayette.
Thank you, sir. Being so young, I had feared to raise my voice.
All voices are needed now. You should know, my dear young friend, that the problem you pose to us is not a new one in our eyes. We have proposed to the Congress that an inspector general be appointed.
Congress again. Talk. How long must this go on, sir?
Possibly until you learn patience, Hamilton. And common charity. Yes, General Conway.
Since we are so clearly getting nowhere whatever, sir, may I suggest that we adjourn? I, for one, have need of sleep. General Wilkinson here, he is asleep.
It would be a shame to wake him. Well, I, too, am weary of debate. Gentlemen, we stand adjourned. Sleep well, General Conway.
Good night, General.
Ah, what a waste of time, these eternal councils. And how characteristic of our so democratic commander.
Our commander at the moment, Conway. What a heavenly aroma. What is it?
Guinea hen. Huh? Well roasted. Well. Prime. And a quart of Rhenish grape to wash it down. And brandy to come.
Oh.
Nice, my friend.
But here at Valley Forge, how do you manage?
I have friends in the Congress at York, General Wilkinson. Good friends. Well placed. Two of them on the board of war. As aide-de-camp to General Gates, you must know how these things are done, eh? Come, Wilkinson. We can understand each other.
Of course.
The friends of General Gates at York are my friends and yours. We can do business, Wilkinson.
Oh? How?
In this matter, Washington has placed himself in an utterly untenable position. Someone is needed to create an army out of this disorganized mob at Valley Forge. So he has recommended to the Board of War that an inspector general be appointed. Do you know who that inspector general will be, Wilkinson?
Who?
Me, General. Me.
You?
It's all arranged. And I am to report directly to the Board of War, not to General Washington. Do you understand?
Could I...
A little brandy, certainly. Now, to us, General Wilkinson, to us, and to our future Commander-in-Chief, General Horatio Gates.
This is the end, Hamilton.
The end. What has happened, sir?
I've just received word from Congress that the Board of War has finally acted on my recommendation. They've appointed an inspector general. They've appointed Conway.
Conway? That French-Irish charlatan? What are we going to do, sir?
We can do nothing. He's not under my command. He will, they instruct me, report directly to the Congress. Oh, it's insufferable. I shall receive him with the courtesy required by his new office and the contempt suggested by his odious person.
If you were to take my advice, sir, you'd march on York and seize power yourself. The men would follow you.
I had forbidden you to mention that vanity again, Hamilton. Perhaps my career is nearing its close. Well, it may end in defeat, but never shall it end in treason.
But, sir, we cannot...
We cannot discuss the matter, Colonel.
I was about to suggest, sir, that our fortunes can descend no lower.
Come in. Yes, Colonel Lawrence?
A message, sir, from one of Dr. Franklin's New England agents.
Let me see it, Lawrence.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Frank has departed from Boston with messages for the governor of Martinique.
Good. Good news, sir?
It may be the answer to our prayers. Dr. Franklin has won an illustrious recruit to our cause. Mr. Frank is the Baron Frederick William von Steuben, the foremost soldier in Europe.
We return to the headquarters of General Washington at Valley Forge, where his shivering army suffers in the snow. Desertions mount daily with the continued failure of supply. And over the commander himself hangs the threat of the infamous Conway Gates cabal. At last, Washington takes steps against the conspirators.
Colonel Lawrence.
Yes, sir.
Prepare a letter to General Conway. And listen to this, Colonel Hamilton.
Yes, General.
You ready, Lawrence?
Yes, sir.
General Conway, a letter which I received last night contained the following paragraph. In a dispatch from General Conway to General Gates, Conway wrote, "Heaven has determined to save your country, General Gates, else a weak commander-in-chief would have ruined it long since." End of quotation, Colonel. Sign the letter, "I remain your humble servant, George Washington."
That is all, sir.
That is all.
General, how did you learn of Conway's letter to Gates?
Wilkinson, in his cups as usual, babbled it out in the hearing of one of my few friends at Gates' headquarters.
But Conway will tell Gates at once, and Gates will think...
Yes, if I know Gates, he will think that you, Colonel, must have examined his dispatches by stealth when you were at his headquarters last week. He trusts no one. And being by nature a fatuous bungler, he will write to me denying that he ever received such a letter from Conway. He will write to Congress also, complaining that I have libeled Conway. Such a hubbub will be raised that the whole plot must come out into the open at last. In the open, they will appear for what they are, subverters of our cause, and arrant fools to boot.
I see, sir. The letter is a slow fuse leading to a barrel of gunpowder at York.
I hope so. I hope so.
Colonel, I trust arrangements have been made to receive the bandman Steuben.
Oh, yes, sir. He'll be met by a headquarters company under Captain Walker on the York Road and escorted here with every honor, sir.
It can't be much longer now. When he comes, I shall ride out to meet him myself.
General Washington, may I present the Baron Frederick William von Steuben.
Welcome, my dear Baron. We've all of us looked forward to your arrival.
General, mine English is not good. I have learned a speech to say to you, so I forget. I am very happy.
Many of our officers are able to converse in French, Baron. Captain Walker here is accomplished in German as well.
Ah, mon ami Walker. Wir haben schon gesprochen. Wir werden uns gut verstehen, no?
Nee, oui. Zu allen Zeiten. Können Sie sicher sein.
Captain Walker, my letters to the Baron, I have hinted at our pitiful condition here. At your earliest opportunity, you will explain to him those things which cannot be said in letters. Tell him our enemy has forced us in these campaigns to fight pitched battles on the European order and on a European scale.
Yes, sir.
We've lost those battles for lack of unified training, for lack of system, for lack of drill. To instill system will be the Baron's work.
I think perhaps the Baron understands English better than he speaks it, General Washington.
Aber ja. Ah, mon général, si, wenn, no, if you but knew how my heart rejoices, how happy I am to do again the work of a soldier. I have come here to work. I go to work at once.
Baron, you bring us new hope.
I tell you, Mistress Green, the like of this man, von Steuben, has not before been seen on our side of the ocean. Why, he's a combination of Don Quixote, Jolly Father Christmas, and Satan himself, all rolled into one, with 7-league boots.
La, and so handsome, too. I do declare, on horseback, he looks like the very god of war.
But, Captain, my husband tells me the men are laughing at your Baron von Steuben, just as we are now.
And is it not good to hear laughter again at Valley Forge, Mrs. Green? They began by laughing at him. In a day's time, they were laughing with him. All day, he labors at the drill ground, pushing and pounding each squad into shape, as if he were a young lieutenant eager for promotion. Each night he spends writing out a new chapter in his manual of war. And I, perforce, stay up to make a fair copy in English. And then six men work until dawn, making more copies for the brigade commanders. At 3 a.m., 3 a.m., mind you, the Baron is up again. He smokes a pipe while his valet dresses his hair. He has one cup of coffee. And at sunrise, he's drilling his beloved model company again. One, two, three, cut. Ein, zwei, drei, four. And I, of course, I'm out there with him, translating all three languages at once.
Poor Captain Walker. You must be worn out. Quite worn out.
On the contrary, Madam Green, I had never felt better in all my life. Since your husband succeeded the wretched Mifflin as quartermaster, I have acquired a warm coat to my back and reasonable rations to warm my innards. And I have work to do. Good work.
Captain, we must meet this paragon of yours.
I shall oblige with great pleasure. And when he meets you, Miss Mead, I know what he'll say.
And what will he say, Captain?
I can hear him now. Wunderschön. Wunderschön. Ah, Liebchen, comme vous êtes belle. How you are épouvantablement. Ravissant! And then Fritz says to me, he says, Sergeant Jenkins, you know what is this? A bayonet, says I. What is for, Sergeant, says he. To roast pig meat on the end of, says I. When we got pig meat, which we ate. Dumb cook, he says, it is for sticking lobster backs into belly. I show you. And he grabs my musket and starts dancing around and stabbing the air like a great Dutch windmill.
Yeah.
got gumdrop, gumdrop. I spray right here. 1, 2, 3, 4. Gum, gum, rock, got gumdrop, gumdrop. I spray right here. 1, 2, 3, 4. Gum, gum, rock, got gumdrop, gumdrop. I spray right here. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Gentlemen of Congress, there you behold an army. When you were last with us, you saw pitiful rabble. I arranged for this review in your honor, gentlemen, so that you might see with your own eyes what has happened.
It is miraculous, General Washington, simply miraculous.
No, sir, it is the result of the genius and hard work of Baron von Steuben, who came to us as a volunteer, without pay.
You know, of course, that Inspector General Conway has tendered us his resignation.
I do. If I may, I would like to nominate as his successor in the office and pay of Inspector General, the Baron Frederick William von Steuben.
Achtung! Feuer! Marsch!
Gentlemen of the staff, little did I think I would live to see the day when it would be possible to serve a banquet at Valley Forge. General Greene has outdone himself with the farmers in the hinterland. And, gentlemen, the occasion is worthy of his efforts. I have news for you. Splendid news.
Yes, sir.
His Majesty King Louis the 16th of France has declared that a state of war exists between his country and Britain. Lafayette.
General, friends, this, you must know, is the happiest moment of my life. May I propose a toast to the people of my country, to France.
To France.
I have further news, hardly less important, hardly less gratifying to me. Baron von Steuben.
Yes, sir.
Baron, from the bottom of my heart, I thank you for the work you've accomplished here. In a few short weeks, you've performed a feat, sir, without parallel in the history of arms. You've surmounted obstacles beyond number. You've turned a sick, despondent mob into a spirited army of disciplined soldiers. You've taught us how to laugh again. My news is this. The Continental Congress has confirmed your appointment, Baron, as Inspector General in the Army of the United States. Another toast to General von Steuben, the architect of our future victory.
Gentlemen, my English is not good, but it is better, no? Yes, I have teach, I have learned much more than what I teach from these men, these sans culottes, these ones without breeches. I have learned what it means, this word, freedom. I have seen, I know, no European soldiers could do what they have done. In Europe is slaves. Here is free men. Another toast. I give you the American private soldier. He is the best fighting man in the world. To our victory.
Shall we join the ladies?
Yes. Congratulations.
Herr Baron?
Ah, mon ami Valcaire. Have you heard?
Yes, it's wonderful. Wonderful, sir.
Oh, Baron, there's a pretty young lady here who wishes to meet you.
But certainly, Capitaine. Jolie, tu dis?
Oh, oui, très jolie, très jolie, très belle. Et elle parle français.
Oh, oh. Où est-elle?
Ici. Miss Mead.
Yes?
May I present Inspector General von Steuben?
Mademoiselle, comme vous êtes belle. Comme vous êtes épouvantablement ravissante!
Now hear Brian Donlevy and his dangerous assignment on NBC.
American Portraits, on Tuned to Yesterday from the 21st of August, 1951, from NBC. And that brings to a close this hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for listening.